Stash number 14128, Frederick Parham, reel 3.
In about the middle of 1942, I was appointed in command of HMS Belfast, a 10,000 cruiser mounting 12 6-inch guns in triple turrets and 8 4-inch anti-aircraft guns, as well as, of course, minor pompons and things. Her displacement was about 10,000 tons. She had been, at the beginning of the war, she was just completed as a brand new ship and was working up before joining the fleet. When coming up harbour in the Firth of Forth, she hit one of the first German magnetic mines ever to be dropped and was very badly damaged. She was paid off and put into dock at Rosyth, where it was first decided that she was so badly damaged that the only thing to do was to break her up. Until somebody, and I always feel his name ought to be known, but I don't know it, some comparatively young constructor said no, he believed that she could be successfully rebuilt. And so, in due course, she was towed round to Devonport and rebuilt. And she was a better ship, really, after she was rebuilt than she was when she was originally built. And I joined her at Devonport and commissioned her, and we eventually arrived at Scapa Flow in the Orkneys just before Christmas 42. It was a happy Christmas, as happy as it could be, and I have a very tender memory of a letter, an anonymous letter, which I had from the mother of one of my young sailors, which read, "Dear Sir, I would like to express my gratitude to you for giving my son such a lovely Christmas. I was worried about him, and it was his first Christmas at sea and away from home. But I no longer worry, as he writes that it will be hard to forget the wonderful time you gave him. Thanking you again and wishing you all a very happy new year, and may it bring peace. I am a very grateful mother." The fleet was at that time commander-in-chief was Admiral Sir John Tovey, who shortly afterwards was relieved by Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser. We in the Belfast did our working up and made ourselves ready to join the fleet properly and be ready for action, and were in the 10th Cruiser Squadron, and we hoisted the flag of Admiral, Rear Admiral he was then, Robert Burnett. He had a most remarkable record. I know when he left my ship, I think he was 58 years old, and at the end of that time he'd had 3 action decorations, all for actions in the Arctic. Anyway, he came to us, and a more really lovable fag officer one simply couldn't have had. We were then, for the next 18 months or so, employed almost exclusively in northern waters. We had one or two little trips across the, well, halfway across the Atlantic, one of them escorting Winston Churchill in one of the Queen Elizabeths, or the Queen Mary, I forget what she was. But on the whole, we were almost exclusively in the Arctic. One of the obvious things, of course, that we were doing not of was the Russian convoys. It's difficult to describe what conditions were like. It was, of course, desperately cold, and in the winter, desperately dark. But of course, for some considerable time round the shortest day, the sun never rose at all above the horizon. We were whacked out with various items of Arctic clothing, including extremely heavy sheepskin-lined overcoat, which I personally simply could not wear because I couldn't bear the weight on my shoulders. And of course, we always had to be at the ready. I slept in a most wretched little hut which had been built on the bridge, because my sea cabin, as originally designed, was two decks down from the bridge, and that, I reckon, was too far away. At sea, I never, of course, undressed at all. I didn't even take my boots off when I went to sleep. Funny enough, talking of boots, one of the problems of this extremely cold weather was that if you were on the bridge for hours at a time, and you then went down, say, to the chart house or the plot or something, which was warm, the first thing that happened was that your feet started to sweat. And then, of course, when you went back to the bridge, you were standing in ice. And I solved that one by getting the young steward who looked after me to cut dozens and dozens and dozens of sheets of newspaper into the shape of my feet, and I put in a fit of them into my sea boots, and when they became really sweaty, I pulled them out and put in clean ones. It seems odd, of course, that in northern waters like that, one of the things one should have to compete with was sweaty feet. Another thing we did beside the Russian convoys was a thing called Patrol White, which I personally disliked more than anything else, I think. The weather was appalling. The Patrol White was instituted with the idea of cutting off any German merchant ships which were endeavouring to slip round and evade our own fleet with the stores and so on for the Germans. And we went up and down in what was called the Denmark Strait, which is the strip of water between the north of Greenland and the ice edge. The weather, as I say, was usually appalling. I remember on one occasion being hove to, just very, very slowly steaming ahead, keeping the wind just on the bow, and that's all we could do. And of course the ice was a problem. I was always afraid of running into the solid ice. Unfortunately, I never did. I'm reminded, whenever I think of that, of the very lovely prayer, which is in the 1662 prayer book, Prayers for Those at Sea, in which this particular one asks God to preserve us from the dangers of the sea and the violence of the enemy, in that order, and how right the writer was. When we weren't doing that, we went back to Scarpa Flow, which was, of course, a pretty grim bit of the Orkneys, but was very different from my memories of Scarpa Flow in the First War, when there was absolutely no amenities at all, and indeed the sailors never got ashore at all, and the officers were allowed just to land and go for a walk and come back, but there was nothing else to do. But Scarpa Flow in this Second War was a very different place. I mean, you couldn't make it any more thrilling to look at, but at least they built a canteen and the sailors were able to get ashore, and there were quite a lot of wrens posted up there, which I think made a lot of difference to the men's life. I'm sure it made them much more human and normal and well behaved. One of the problems was keeping the ship's company informed about what was going on. And I remember carrying their deck one day and explaining to the ship's company that obviously a tremendous amount of what I knew was in store for us must be absolutely secret, that I would always tell them all that I was allowed to tell them, and that I hoped never actually having to lie to them, but that I would, if necessary, for our safety. I can remember, for example, an occasion when tremendous efforts had been put in to put on a concert ashore, and I was consulted about it, and I allowed all the arrangements to go forward, and I knew all the time that on the date for which the concert was arranged, we should be halfway to Murmansk with a Russian convoy. Well, life went on like that until the great day arrived when we fought at the Battle of the North Cape. It's very difficult to describe that battle and the whole of that day. Particularly is it difficult to remember the times when things happened, because, as I said before, this was Act Johnson Stevens Day, the 26th of December, and as I said before, it was so difficult to tell what time of day it was, because there was practically no difference in the light, which was almost permanently pitch dark. There was a very, very, very faint glimmer of twilight at about noon. After the battle was over, I remember telling a fellow in the Admiralty who was one of the people who had to go through the dispatches and to say what he made of them, that the only way really to understand that battle, if he wanted to, was to take the dispatches with him into a fridge and read them by the light of a small nightlight, and preferably with someone rocking the fridge from side to side. The situation then was that in the north of Norway were stationed the Tirpitz, the Germans' largest battleship, which was disabled. She'd been disabled partly by air attack and partly by midget submarines. And the Scharnhorst, in perfect condition, a large battle cruiser mounting 9 11-inch guns plus 12 6-inch, which, as I said before, the 12 6-inch was exactly what our armament was. But early in December 43, we were out with a convoy to Murmansk. And then we were detailed to escort the returning convoy of empty ships bound for Great Britain. The convoys had a close escort of destroyers and smaller craft who were their protection against U-boats. The escorting cruiser squadron kept close at hand, but not too close, to beat off anything large, such as the Scharnhorst, as might arrive to attack the convoy. We were not allowed to do less than 80 knots with their submarines. So what we really did was to make enormous circles, well, not enormous, but make circles round and round the convoy, which was very slow. Some of the merchant ships could only do about 7 knots, and keep, as I say, within touch, so that we were there if anything large arrived to attack them. But on the evening of Christmas Day, 1943, we had a warning from the Admiralty that it was believed that the Scharnhorst was probably putting to sea. And we were ordered to push on from ahead of the convoy which we were protecting, which, as I say, was on its way back to England, and to cover another convoy which was on its way out from England and was about halfway to Murmansk. I remember very well having a long discussion with my Admiral Burnett, in the chart house about what we should do if so and so happened and so on, and then I think finished at about midnight, after which I'm proud, no, I wouldn't say proud, I'd say profoundly thankful that I slept like a top. Well, up early, of course, obviously the next morning, and our first encounter with the Scharnhorst, who had come to attack that very convoy, was at 8:40 a.m. She, incidentally, had started out, we had learnt afterwards, with about 3 or 4 destroyers with her, which would have made an immense difference, I think, to the whole business that day. But they, in the foul weather which was going on then, had lost her, I think, and I'd been gone home. Anyway, we had, as I say, this first encounter at about 8:40, and to astonishment, after quite a short time of exchanging fire with the Shark Horse. Oh, I should have explained, we had two other cruisers with us, the Norfolk, an 8-inch cruiser, and the Sheffield, which was a slightly older edition of ourselves. And anyway, we in spite of our comparative small size, the Scharnhorst turned north and made away at high speed. And this is where my Admiral Burnett had to make his really big decision. And I am absolutely convinced that it was the right one. Which was that he was not to follow the Scharnhorst, either with his cruiser squadron or to catch another cruiser to follow her and try and keep her in sight. Because we couldn't possibly have kept up. The weather was so bad that she would have outstripped us and would merely have got round us and probably back onto the convoy. And so my Admiral's decision was to fall back onto the convoy and wait to see. I remember saying to me, "I bet you'll come again." The point, of course, was that the Duke of York battleship, fleet flagship of the fleet, was then, I don't really know, but about 150 to 200 miles away. Accompanied by a cruiser, the Jamaica, and a flotilla of destroyers, had come out from Iceland so as to be around the place if anything like this occurred. So it was vital that the Commander-in-Chief in the Duke of York should be kept aware of where the Scharnhorst was. Well, as I say, my Admiral took his big decision in spite of that, not to follow up at that moment, but to fall back on the convoy, which we did. And we had detached from the close escort then was a half flotilla of destroyers led by the Musketeer. And I can see it in my mind now. I was on the bridge all the time, and my Admiral was down in the plot. We were, of course, had a short voice by between us and were constantly in touch. And I could see, of course, the Musketeers' division of destroyers, and just very, very faintly beyond some ships, or anyway, a ship, and which I took to be the leading ships of the outgoing convoy. And suddenly up came the Musketeer with a signal to my Admiral, which said, "Am awaiting your order to attack." So it rather shook me when the signal was reported to me on the bridge. So I rang out on the voice pipe. We just had the most extraordinary signal there from the Musketeer. "Am awaiting your order to attack." I thought to myself, well, she can't be waiting to be told to attack if there is any to attack. So what does this mean? And my Admiral was a bit rattled too by it. So he replied to the Musketeer, "Attack what?" To which the Musketeer cheerfully replied, "Oh, anything that turns up," which of course was very funny afterwards, but was not at all funny at the time. Well, we went on from our first encounter, which as I say was about 8:40, until noon, when as I said, there was just the glimmering of twilight. And there, bearing down on the convoy, or rather on us, but hoping to find the convoy, was the Scharnhorst again, rushing towards us head on. And we opened fire at one another, and it was simply a question then, really, of whose nerve broke first, and hers did. Because after about 20 minutes, she turned to the south, and it was then obviously legging it for home to her port in which she was stationed, in the north coast of Norway. The Norfolk was hit during that engagement and had to fall back to fight a fire. She had quite a considerable number of casualties. And it's interesting that she had ordinary cordite for firing her guns. We in the Sheffield had flashless cordite, which I think quite possibly accounts for the fact that she was hit and we weren't. The next thing that happened was that the Sheffield's engine started to give trouble and she had to slow down. And so we were then left alone, proceeding at very high speed, in fact, practically as fast as we could possibly go, the Scharnhorst was barely in sight and soon got out of sight, but we had her the whole time on our radar. And we were still firing at her, and she was firing back at us, pushing and hitting. And I remember my admiral saying to me after the voice five, "Do you think there's any point in going on firing at her?" And I said, "No, I don't think there is. In fact, I think it'd be a bigger thing if we didn't." And so we ceased fire, and as soon as we ceased fire, so did the Scharnhorst. And I'm quite certain that what must have happened was that her radar had been shot away in one of our first two actions or both, and I'm quite certain that she had no idea that we were following her. Otherwise, she need only have turned round for 10 minutes or less and blown us clean out of the water. And then, of course, she'd have been lost to everybody and absolutely safe to get home. And that connection's interesting, that just before the Duke of York appeared on the scene, which was much later, we heard afterwards from survivors of the Scharnhorst that her captain's last broadcast, just before the Duke of York arrived, was that he reckoned that they were home and dry, or safely home, or whatever he said. So anyway, we went on for just over 4 hours shadowing the Scharnhorst, proceeding, as I said, practically full speed the whole way, and keeping, of course, the Commander-in-Chief and the Duke of York informed by wireless of the exact position and course and speed of the Scharnhorst. And then came the great moment when the Duke of York, we couldn't see her, of course, but the Duke of York reckoned she was within range of the Scharnhorst and made us the signal, "Illuminate this tar shell," which we did, and we opened fire again, and so did the Duke of York and her, the ships that were with her. The first effect, it was interesting to know that when the Duke of York, when the Scharnhorst was illuminated and the Duke of York was able to fire at her, she actually had her turrets fallen off. She had no idea that there was anybody near her at all. She doubled back for a moment when she first sighted the Duke of York, and then made away as fast as she could to the eastward. We went to the northern to make quite sure that she didn't try to escape that way. In effect, during the course of her battle with Duke of York, she did in fact try to do just that, and we who had been out of range came under fire again, and we had another brief action with her ourselves. Well, the battle, it seemed to me, at the end of a very long and very cold and very tiring day, to go on forever, actually lasted for 2 hours, but the Scharnhorst slowly, slowly drawing ahead. Then she suddenly slowed down. She'd been hit by one of the Duke of York's guns. I suppose somewhere down by the feathers or somewhere. Anyway, it slowed her down, and that gave a chance for the destroyers with the Duke of York, the Savage, the Scorpion, the Somerset, and a Norwegian destroyer called the Stord, to go in and deliver a torpedo attack. I've never seen anything like it. To see these four splendid little ships getting into very, very close range, with the Scharnhorst, whose main armament by then I think was completely out of action, but simply streaming fire at these destroyers with every small gun that she'd got. And there were, of course, some of them hit and had considerable casualties. And then we had our chance and attacked by torpedo. We came to hit there, but whether we really got one, I don't know. And the Duke of York at that moment cared out of it, because the torpedo, the sea was absolutely alive with torpedoes. There was nothing more she could do. And she, the Commander Chief made a signal to us to find out where the Scharnhorst was and what the situation was. And in fact, she disappeared. she had, of course, sunk. But no one actually ever saw her sink. But she disappeared and sank 11 hours after our first encounter with her in the morning. We went in to try and see her. We never saw her. But the only thing we did see was an enormous raft with a very large crowd of men, about 30 or 40 of them, shouting and yelling. And our destroyer stopped and picked them up. And they were the only survivors, and incidentally including their officers. So that they couldn't, the fellows who were saved, were not able to tell us a great deal, not that there was a great deal probably to tell, of what had happened. Well, after all that very high-speed steaming, we could no longer go on with our return to home, which is what we started out to do, but we had to go back again to Murmansk, to Fuel, and so did the Duke of York. In fact, all the ships that had taken part in the action. And the interesting thing was that the actual name of the harbour is the Kola Inlet, which leads to Murmansk. And the nearest German airfield was only 20 miles away. And I remember thinking to myself, and there we were all, with oilers alongside, pumping in oil, at the anchor. And I remember thinking to myself, well, here's a chance, of course, for the German Air Force to get its revenge for this business. But the Russians were good. They kept the air full of fighters. And anyhow, it was pitch dark, as I said many times before. And not a single German aircraft appeared. The Duke of York and her party were away first. And finally, we left, the cruiser squadron, that's the Belfast, the Norfolk, and the Sheffield, left for home as fast as we could go. And we entered Scarpa. I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was well towards night, and received a tremendous welcome from all the ships who were lying there. Our only casualty was a reindeer, which had been suddenly and quite unexpectedly presented to us, a live one, before we left the Kola Inlet, the first time, before we left Charles. And we didn't quite know what to do with her, but we put her in a disused aircraft hangar. The poor thing, she couldn't stand the sound of the gunfire and went mad and had to be shot. I'm not sure what happened to the corpse, whether it was eaten or not, I can't tell you. There's another rather nice little story to wind up on. Told me by the captain of the Sheffield, Charles Addis. He'd got onto his bunk at whatever it was, about 2 o'clock in the morning or something, for a few hours sleep, and was called there later on in the morning by his steward with a cup of tea. And old Charles Addis, being sort of frightfully, you know, public school and sang-froid and all that, said to this chap, "Well, Morton, that was rather a good little party we had yesterday, wasn't it?" To which the man replied, "Well, makes a change, sir." Well, now, that's really all to say about that, except the tremendous effect that it had on naval strategy. It wasn't just a matter of one large German ship being sunk. Up till that point, any Russian convoy, really, was a major fleet operation.